They're selling the vaccines to us at a profit. They're walking away with taxpayers' money to be able to do the research. Since the 1930s, taxpayers in America have spent more than $900 billion through the NIH on publicly funded research that drug companies have taken and put it into the patented drugs and made billions of dollars on.
The pharmaceutical industry is raking in trillion-dollar profits during the COVID pandemic, while millions of people around the world still don't have access to the COVID-19 vaccine.
The buyer, seller, middleman, manufacturer, private hospitals, contractors, and transporters all make high profits from vaccination.
Secret backroom deals in Turkey. Compliments of Goldman Sachs.
There's no speculators involved. There's no private interest. There's no attempt to make profit internally within Cuba through the development of these drugs. And that is such a different model.
And Cuba, a country under sanctions from the West, is offering vaccine options to its people and to the world. From Pacifica Radio, this is COVID, Race and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from the Pacifica Network and radio affiliates focused on COVID-19 and the many ways in which this pandemic touches people's lives. I am your host, Tanya Horlick of KMUD 91.1 FM, Garberville, California. We start with an update on the condition of political prisoner, former Black Panther, author, and radio journalist Mumia Abu-Jamal. Pacifica's Anne Garrison reports.
Mumia Abu-Jamal is facing open-heart surgery in Pennsylvania. I spoke to Mumia's supporter and City University of New York professor Johanna Fernandez.
Mumia essentially was able to call his wife yesterday ever so briefly. And at that point, he was very weak and was only able to whisper to her that he would be undergoing surgery on Monday. That's what we know.
Do you know of any response to the campaign to remove the 4-point restraint shackles ahead of Mumia's surgery?
There's no response on that front. What we do know is that at least until yesterday, the prison recorded a statement or message for those who were calling on behalf of Mumia. And I don't know the details of what that message was or if it remains on their system. But that's a signal that people are calling, that they're paying attention, that they're being forced to develop and craft a message to essentially tell supporters to step back.
Are you nevertheless still asking people to contact the Pennsylvania governor and other officials about removing the shackles before surgery?
Absolutely. Medically, the shackling of a patient is barbaric. It should be illegal for a hospital, for a nurse, or a doctor to implement a policy that is, objectively speaking, contrary to the health of their patient.
Okay, where can people find the governor's phone number and those of other officials to contact?
They can go to letmumiaout.com for this information.
Today, I read in a medical journal that 4-point restraints are used for patients with psychiatric illnesses or altered mental status who become violent and dangerous in the emergency department. That's obviously not Mumia. So I think we can assume that this is about punishment and making an example of him. Could you talk about the example the state of Pennsylvania is making of Mumia?
Well, unfortunately, this is not particular to Mumia, although Mumia is a special case. He is a political prisoner who was framed by the Philadelphia police in 1981. The practice of shackling prisoners is a widespread practice across the country and in Pennsylvania for certain. And part of what I've written and what we know is that this is truly an echo of slavery. I mean, the echoes of slavery here are loud and clear. Chattel slavery in the Americas is the institution which, for the first time in human history, produced the global distribution, but also the mass use of handcuffs, shackles, and fetters to bring enslaved Africans to heal. So part of what we see, as James Baldwin has written, is that history is in the present, and we're living with history in unconscious ways. Now, every generation, it seems, the American government has sought to make an example of people who dare to fight the status quo, to fight empire, to fight the state. In the late 19th century, it was the Haymarket martyrs, anarchist, socialist, communist, labor activists who were literally sent to their deaths, executed for their labor activism in that period. After that, in the early 20th century, we had the case of Sacco and Vanzetti, two Italian anarchists who were also executed, sent to their deaths by the state for their political activism. And in the post-civil rights and Black Power movement era, the show trial for the state was that of Mumia Abu-Jamal, sentenced to death in the 1980s for the alleged killing of a white police officer. Mumia is a former Black Panther, a muckraker, radio journalist, award-winning radio journalist at the time of his incarceration, and wrote a New York Times bestseller, From Death Row, the first book that humanized death row from the inside. And in the 1990s, you probably recall that Mumia Abu-Jamal was like the Che Guevara of our time. He was resisting empire from the inside, defying everything that we think of when we think of someone on death row. And this is what the state does. It wants to make an example of people who resist the state, to send the message that this is what might happen to you if you dare challenge the highest authority in the country. So the Fraternal Order of Police, which is the largest police organization in the world, has made a poster child of Mumia, the man that they hate. And the Fraternal Order of Police has essentially funded many of the judges in Pennsylvania. Most of the judges who've heard Mumia's case in Pennsylvania have been funded by the Fraternal Order of Police. That's because in Pennsylvania, judges run for office. This is a political case. It involves a veteran Black Panther and a white police officer.
And that was City University of New York, Professor Johanna Fernandez. For the full version of this conversation, go to our website, covidtaskforce.pacifica.org.
This is COVID, Race and Democracy. I'm your host, Tanya Horlick. COVID-19 vaccines are now available, but to whom and at what price? Author Gerald Posner argues that the pharmaceutical industry has engaged in massive profiteering at taxpayers' expense and with no real accountability.
In the beginning of COVID, the very first bill that was passed, so we have Trump as president, we have a Democratic Congress, was an $8 billion funding bill passed in a couple of weeks. $3 billion was money shoved to the pharmaceutical companies for research on the COVID vaccine. And in the first draft of the bill, there were two features. One said the government would have real power, the price was too high. And the second was, guess what? No intellectual property rights. You get this taxpayer money, you have to share the research and information. By the time that bill passed in 2 weeks, those two features were out. The money was given, no strings attached. So Democrats and Republicans had to agree. And in the end, that's the problem. Corporate Democrats, Republicans who are in the pocket, the pharma has enough friends on both sides of the aisle that the people who suffer are us, the consumers. 1976, for anybody who may remember it, when Gerald Ford was president, we had a swine flu scare for a while. The Ford administration kicked into swine flu was going to be the same thing as the 1917 and 18 epidemic. Everybody got nervous. They got these four drug companies to put together all of these vaccines. And then the government went to them and said, by the way, give us the vaccines. And before the drug companies would turn them over, they wanted from the government an absolute guarantee that they were not responsible for any liability concerns. The Ford administration gave it to them. We administered about 40 million of those doses of swine flu before everyone realized there was no pandemic. And guess what? About 5,000 people developed this rare neurological debilitating brain syndrome called Guillain-Barré. The government had to pay out all those claims. The drug companies walked away scot-free and made all their profits from the vaccines. Same thing happening now on COVID. They're selling the vaccines to us at a profit. They're walking away with taxpayers' money to be able to do the research. That's not surprising because since the 1930s, taxpayers in America have spent more than $900 billion through the NIH on publicly funded research that drug companies have taken and put it into patented drugs and made billions of dollars on. But now they're taking all those profits, and no matter what happens, blood clots, whether there's long-term effects or whatever else, we will end up paying the money because the government's going to subsidize all of those injuries, not the drug companies. It's disgraceful. almost the early part of the pandemic last year when they were first looking at vaccines. For anybody who was listening, I was saying this is not going to be what the drug company calls one in, one out. One in, one out means they give you one shot and for decades you're protected, sort of like the polio vaccine or what they had with measles. They were looking for something that with the coronavirus, even though it was a novel virus, was going to be a little bit more like influenza. So the idea that this was not just going to be a multi-billion dollar profit for them for one shot, but would be a continuing revenue source in the future was big. And whether you want to call it a booster shot or an annual shot, or when COVID has a bad year at some point and sparks up and they get to stockpile more with the governments, that's clearly going to happen. The part about the intellectual property rights, the patents, is so disturbing because there was an institution in Norway founded in 2015 called the Coalition for Epidemics and Pandemics. I wrote about it in the New York Times in an op-ed last March, and it was developed with all of the help of Western countries, the US, Europe, and with drug companies, saying, let's prepare for the next pandemic. And if one comes, we'll share all our research. We'll get together and we'll keep prices low. Well, guess what? That worked on paper, but the minute the real pandemic came, everybody forgot about that. Drug companies refused to go along with it. And instead of having anybody with the ability to enforce it, political leaders lost their will. They got nervous. They worried about getting the vaccine at all costs, and therefore they let the drug companies determine the terms. And that, I assure you, is not the way to get a good deal when it comes to pharmaceutical industry. What I call the people's vaccines, and you know that's a real tongue-in-cheek in some ways, but the least expensive ones, the ones that were AstraZeneca. AstraZeneca agreed to market its vaccine at what it said was its cost. Nobody can really get in there and determine the cost, but it was $5, $4 a dose versus $20 a dose for Pfizer. So it's really at a low rate. It's much easier to distribute because it doesn't need to be in these freezers and large containers. It can be transported around the world into developing nations. The same with Johnson & Johnson, going to be priced much lower, under $10, and also much easier to distribute. Those two low-priced vaccines are the ones hitting the road bumps. You know, all of a sudden, speed bumps along the way, possible blood clots. There's questions about their effectiveness. So what are we left with? The gold standard now are the most expensive vaccines, not surprisingly. It's Pfizer and Moderna, $20 each, where there's real profit margins, much harder to distribute, much tougher for countries like India, South Asia, across Africa to get. When it comes to medicine, capitalism is at its most difficult sort of question mark when it comes to public health. And we, meaning the United States, are the only country in the world crazy enough, and I do use the word crazy meaning it, to allow drug companies unfettered pricing power. We allow them to set whatever price they want. In every other country, there's some mechanism for negotiating prices, whether it's with a group, a medical committee group, or whether it's with the government, whether it's public health, or like in NHS, the National Health Service in Britain, which is a government health service. So here, even in COVID, for instance, there's a company in California called Gilead. They had a failed drug product called remdesivir, which, by the way, they had had $75 million in public money, taxpayer money, to try to develop. They were looking at something to treat, not COVID, but originally they were dealing with Ebola. Didn't work. So it's sitting on the shelf. Now, all of a sudden, COVID comes around, and the bright people at Gilead say, hey, maybe we can, it's a viral drug, we can refashion this, it can do something for COVID. It turns out it got FDA approval very, very fast. It saves, according to Gilead, 5 days in the hospital. So they priced it, $2,200 for the treatment around the world. Except in the United States, where it's priced at $3,300. Why? Because they can get away with it. And they did. And nobody in the US government, Nancy Pelosi or Mitch McConnell, stood up and said, this is a disgrace. They just said, okay, that's fine. And they went on to the next issue. And I'm not sure why we allow unbridled capitalism, in essence, to take place with drugs, where at least everybody, I think, could agree we can have a system that puts some limits and controls on them.
You've been listening to Gerald Posner, author of Pharma, Greed, Lies, and the Poisoning of America. For Pacifica, this is Steve Zeltzer.
Corruption in the distribution of COVID-19 vaccines is a global phenomenon, and Turkey is no exception.
Reporting for Pacifica, this is Mehmet Bayram.
On Gulden Yazgan, yesterday a prosecutor walked into a hospital at full capacity in the town of Osmaniye in Turkey. He had no appointment. There were patients waiting everywhere to see a doctor. The doctor in charge of the clinic had taken a leave and another doctor was sent temporarily to run the operation. The prosecutor barged into the office of the doctor, who was with another patient. As the reports indicate, he demanded to be seen immediately ahead of all others because he was the district attorney. The attending physician told him to wait outside as he had somebody in his office. Security forces immediately shut down the clinic for the day, and the police caught the doctor. He was handcuffed and taken to the police station to be questioned.
The hospitals are in full capacity in Turkey, with the number of COVID cases not easing up. Wave after wave, the rising number of patients have taken every available bed. It's hard to bring the supporters of capitalism to talk about for-profit healthcare in public. They prefer secret backroom dealings and closed sessions to discuss how much profit they will make on human life and death. The best example of these backroom dealings emerged when Goldman Sachs analysts questioned if curing patients with a short-term treatment was good for business. Back in 2018, a report from CNBC expressed a business dilemma for making a buck. Should the patients be kept on a leash and milked like a cow, or should the sick be treated and sent home?
No, it's not the lack of morals of one business analyst that's at play here. When the system of capitalism allows services and goods to be provided to the society, if and only if the few owners of the means of production are permitted a cut, the entire humanity loses. The issue is most acute in health services, but we can easily make the same argument in housing, food, education, utilities, and other areas. The COVID-19 pandemic and its aftermath became a bonanza for the health capitalists. Irrational solutions that prioritize profit-making stood in front of stopping the deadly spread of the virus. Instead of discussing the best way to fight the disease, the discussions turned to how best to accommodate the business community. The drug corporations feeding on taxpayers' funds worked in secret behind closed doors to compete for their vaccine's market share.
The only logical approach of all scientists sharing information and working together to find a cure wasn't even discussed in mainstream media because it goes against profit-making principles. If the scientific community worked together, collaborated, shared, cooperated openly, a vaccine would have been found, manufactured, and distributed with the utmost efficiency. What we are witnessing is the sacrifice of human lives for the sake of profit. Her name was Aslı Özkısırlar. She lived in İzmir, Turkey, and she came to the attention of the country when she tweeted on March 24th that she'd been waiting more than 10 days to get a hospital bed. She said,
"There's no bed to be found. However, yes, please do go ahead and meet with your party conferences. Why should my pain and suffering matter to you?"
She was referring to the ruling party's ongoing conferences attended by thousands bussed in by the government for political shows with no masks or precautions around the country. Thousands fell ill and were hospitalized after each meeting, but an order from above stopped all social media sharing of those who caught the virus at the party conventions because it didn't look good. On March 31st, she was pleading,
"We asked millions of people trying to find someone who could find a way to get me to a hospital. Someone knew the head of the hospital who called me to come in tomorrow. Whatever you have, luck or prayer, please send my way."
The very next day, she was dead. What we are witnessing is the sacrifice of human lives for profit.
With privatized hospitals organized around maximizing profits and employing a minimum level of healthcare professionals to maintain competitiveness, patients' lives are lost.
A government contractor is importing the vaccines in Turkey, but refuses to disclose the cost of each jab because it is a trade secret. The buyer, seller, middleman, manufacturer, private hospitals, contractors, and transporters all make high profits from vaccination. Taxpayers pay for all these, yet they are not allowed to know how much. vaccination programs are dangerously behind, with the government promising to restart vaccinations in late September, and Turkey leads in the number of cases and deaths in the world. A new vaccine tourism industry has started, with the rich traveling to Serbia, Russia, and even to the US to get vaccinated. All this while plastic surgeons are booked full for hair transplants, nose jobs, and facelifts with patients from all over the Middle East.
The Health Minister of Turkey, Fahrettin Koca, is the Vice President of the Business Council of the Foreign Economic Relations Council Education Committee. He is well-versed in trading, buying, selling, and owning private hospitals. He owns one of the largest private hospital chains and medical universities. Media showed that his hospitals were charging excessively for corona tests when public hospitals weren't given test kits. His private hospitals are seen as above the law. They do not abide by the rules and regulations of hospitals. The government keeps handing out historical and touristic public buildings to him free of charge to turn them into his private hospitals and make huge profits.
This is the age of barbarism, theft, corruption, and profiteering brought on by capitalism. The commodification of human lives has caused millions of deaths, not the virus. Reporting for Pacifica, this is Mehmet Bayram.
And Gülden Yazgan.
Most of our problems, a vaccine will not stop. It won't end evictions or abolish killer cops. But when we have protests, we can sing into a mic without worrying about a viral spike. Get back to the life we had before. You know, growing inequality and an impending civil war. Such a precipice we're on in so many places. But soon maybe we'll meet it without masks upon our faces. And we can hug and kiss and groom. Vaccine.
This is COVID, Race and Democracy. I'm your host, Tanya Horlick. One country 90 miles off the coast of the U.S. has not only contained the coronavirus, but also developed several low-cost vaccines for the people of Latin America and the rest of the world. WBAI host Doug Henwood interviewed economist and historian Helen Yaffe about how Cuba's socialist society handled the pandemic differently.
Key to understanding Cuba's ability to develop its biopharma sector is education, mass education, huge investments in education to make education accessible and free to everyone in Cuba. And that is necessary to create the kind of critical mass of science graduates that are needed to be able to, you know, advance into biotechnology and to set up the medical science sector. So education and public health being developed, receiving huge investments under the revolutionary government of 1959 in parallel. And then they actually began to develop the biotech sector as a conscious development strategy. In the very early 1980s, Cuba was one of the first countries to set up an institution to develop this sector. It was the first time in Cuba's economic history that it had been at the vanguard of a developing global sector. Only 5 years after the world's first biotech firm was set up in the United States, and the Cubans had set up an institute called the Biological Front. So, yes, it was very much part of a conscious strategy. It was very much a project that was promoted by Fidel Castro, who had a vision about the importance of, since the beginning of the revolution, had a vision about the importance of science and technology for social development, not for private interest, profit and speculation. So the biotech sector is consistent with all of those characteristics. It's set up by state funds, is controlled, 100% ownership by the state. They have dozens of institutions which do not compete in terms of resources or finances, only in terms of the race for innovation and so on. It's directed towards serving public health needs. There's a great fluid communication and integration between the public health sector, the biotech sector, the universities and research institutes. And these factors explain the fast track that the Cubans have had between the basic science, when they start the basic science and research, into development of new drugs and into application within the public healthcare system. And those are exactly the characteristics which have helped Cuba to really stand out in the global pandemic. It identified a global health need. That was the coronavirus. It had different institutions collaborating, sharing resources. Both of these different platforms that they're using are actually the result of collaborations between different resources. There's no speculators involved. There's no private interest. There's no attempt to make profit internally within Cuba through the development of these drugs. And that is such a different model from what we see in the United States, where the biotech sector first developed and which really set the model for the rest of the world. I mean, the first biotech firm was set up by a venture capitalist with a biochemist. And, you know, for many years, and even now, there are many biotech companies that produce nothing. They produce no products for the medical system. They produce no drugs for people's healthcare, and yet they make money. And they do this by using financial mechanisms like IPOs and so on, through the stock exchange, through the NASDAQ, through high-risk investments. And essentially, that is the main purpose of those companies. In Cuba, it's the opposite. And they've said that very clearly in relation to the COVID-19 pandemic. They have their biotech sector to meet public health needs. If in the process, through exports, they can make some revenues, they can plow back into their system, then that's great. But that's a secondary consideration.
So this is a living refutation of the capitalist doctrine that you need intellectual property protections, competition, and profit to make things happen. It's a living refutation of that state-dominated system cannot innovate.
Yeah, it's taken the prevailing dogma, I'd say, and the Cubans have turned it on their head. And I think that is the reason that it's coming to attention now. Yes, it is producing very concrete results that meet emergency needs right now. But it's also an alternative model which challenges this neoliberal dogma that the only way to achieve efficiency is through self-interest, through the market, and so on. And I think that this pandemic has brought into question what the very meaning of efficiency is, because Boris Johnson, the Prime Minister of Britain, was reported to have been boasting the other day about how capitalism and greed were behind the British success with the vaccines and in terms of COVID-19. And, you know, actually it's dishonest, because the situation is the same in the United States, but the AstraZeneca Oxford vaccine was developed with tens of millions of public money. You know, that was ploughed into it, but the profits are privatized. And the same is the case in the United States. The National Institutes of Health receive hundreds of millions of dollars every year of public money to fund research, the gains of which, the financial gains of which, go into private pockets. It's the privatization of social wealth, and that's the process. And the Cubans demonstrate that actually it can be more efficient if your objective is meeting a public health need at this point, an urgent global health need, which has the global economy at some sort of a standstill, and means that, you know, people are struggling to make a living.
That was Helen Yaffe, lecturer in economic and social history at the University of Glasgow and author of We Are Cuba, How a Revolutionary People Have Survived in a Post-Soviet World, published last year by Yale University Press.
El camino se hace al andar, mirando el mar de lejos, solo veo tu reflejo viejo. Los ladridos son de bar, construyendo cambio, captivando la conciencia de los jóvenes del barrio. Si no lo vivo, ¿cómo lo aprendo? Si no trabajo, ¿cómo lo arriendo? Tiene moneda, pues dale al pueblo, tiene la gana o le empeño.
This is COVID, Race and Democracy. I'm your host, Tanya Horlick. For over a decade, the World Economic Forum has been discussing a plan called the Fourth Industrial Revolution. Here is its founder, Charles Schwab.
COVID-19, if anything, has accelerated this ongoing industrial revolution. If COVID had happened even 10 years ago, we could not have imagined moving entire companies, schools, and government offices so fast online. Today, that is a reality. The fourth industrial revolution has become a reality, not just for the pioneers, but for a broad range of people and workers. We are also seeing macroeconomic consequences, changes. Big tech companies such as Apple, Samsung, Alphabet, Amazon, or Facebook already are among the largest global companies, but the last months have further cemented their leading positions in the market, while others have started to lag further behind. That will prove to be not only the case now, but will be a permanent consequence of COVID-19. But this past few months have also shown that the fourth industrial revolution will not be beneficial to all unless we make conscious choices and investments to ensure that this is the case. Disadvantaged school students, unskilled workers, and non-digitized companies and governments will feel the crisis much more than others. Moreover, both corporate and income inequality have worsened during the last months. So when we build the post-COVID world, when we do the Great Reset, one of the most important places to start will be to ensure that the fruits of the fourth industrial revolution are really shared by all.
Alison McDowell is a researcher who has been reporting on how these plans will affect the working class of this country.
I just wanted to speak a little bit about the health management aspect and the reality of what happened with the pandemic, at least in the US, that certain populations appear to have much higher negative impacts of this illness, whether the nature of that was, you know, incentives to put people on ventilators, which were definitely the bad choice, or it's possible that there were other aspects in which certain racialized groups were targeted, like with the Navajo Nation and with the Black community, especially in New York City, that they had very high levels of bad outcomes. And so it's important to understand in this larger framing, because what we're seeing now is a framing for a much longer range program. People need to understand it's a much longer range program. It's not just COVID. This is this new normal that they're trying to impose. The impact sectors, I had said, were education, healthcare, and housing. Essentially, they are going to weaponize social determinants of health. They are going to weaponize pre-existing health disparities in communities that are very real disparities in our country in terms of access to healthcare, access to healthy food, access to stable housing. There are real issues of intergenerational trauma that are connected in these communities. But all of these things are actually now going to make those communities targets for impact investors. And those impact markets don't actually benefit from this problem being solved. No global market is going to eliminate the source of its profit. So they will manage your trauma, they will manage your poverty, they will manage your food access, but they will never actually give you autonomy to get out of the situation, right? That's how this is going to work. And so we need to look at COVID and health management, because that's where Michael Bloomberg comes in. And I think too many people are focused on Bill Gates. He's convenient because essentially he covers over a lot of other individuals like Piero Omidyar and Mark Benioff and Michael Bloomberg, who are the people that are going to be running this, the data dashboards, that are going to be managing people when they're in between pandemics. Like, because now we have to optimize our health always, because we never know when the next pandemic is going to come. So we really have to be like well-honed machines and always on top of things, because there's that thing out there that's going to come after us. And that's the framing that they want us to buy into. And that is going to happen in this ubiquitous sensors are these smart cities. And the smart cities are inherently militarized cities. The internet is a military technology. It's birthed out of the military. And the smart city technologies come from New York City, and it's their partnership with Microsoft and Michael Bloomberg and the Federal Reserve. And so it is all a financialized police state, essentially, these smart environments. This is hedge funds that are setting this up. It's Davos, and it is the most powerful institutions of wealth in the world. If folks look up Impact Management Project, there are all the 2,000 top asset holders in the world, but it's the Saudi Sovereign Wealth Fund, it's the Vatican Bank, it's the Mormons, it's Jack Ma, it's SoftBank, it's TIAA CREF, it's your pension fund, it's your insurance fund. It's because at this point, people don't have the liquidity to both acquire enough product to grow the economy at the rate at which capitalism demands. You know, everyone is in debt. And then their carrying capacity of the planet is somewhat reached, right? Like, we're reaching the threshold of growth. So they want you to put on your Fitbit. They want to track you and make sure that you're doing what you're supposed to. In the impact markets, that's what the hedge funds are going to bet on. Did you meet your step goals today? Did you meditate? Did your head brainwave bands? You know, now we've mixed in these wearable technologies. And what's really chilling is that there's something called the DNA nudge band, that the Imperial College, one of their divisions, actually developed something called the DNA nudge, which was a wearable wrist technology that you would scan your food. And it would supposedly, based on your DNA, tell you optimally what food you should buy. And people are like, well, that's crazy. Who would ever do that, right? Well, it's crazy unless to get your food assistance, you have to scan your purchases that way, right? Or you're locked down and Amazon will only deliver the things that you're allowed to have. And then they track if you ate it. Maybe you have to have a sensor to show you recycled it properly. And again, I'm all about that people should have access to affordable, healthy food, right? And that you should have access to employment that lets you have a wage to buy that food and time off to cook it in an enjoyable way and eat it with your friends and like have all of those things. But you do not want to put nanotech and wearable technology and all of that and have Michael Bloomberg's police state looking over your shoulder, which is really what we're looking at, because the NHS actually arranged to buy 6.5 million of these nudge bands connected to the COVID test.
That was researcher Allison McDowell.
Whole planet's in trouble, paradise lays in rubble, empire's bubble has started to burst. Perfect storms form, as the poets all warn. For the proletariat, it will only get worse. Agents of reform, beaten, battered down and worn. These scoundrels don't know compromise. Damn their fear and lies, our destiny cries. We need a revolution now. Need a revolution now.
Teachers Against Dying is a website set up by Texas history teacher Michael Hull to warn and help protect teachers who were being coerced to go back to work under unsafe working conditions. Here's Michael Hull.
The reason I founded the group Teachers Against Dying is because of other teacher groups that were called Safe Reopening, but I noticed it wasn't militant enough. It was kind of normalizing things like, where do I buy a mask? Or what's the best mask? Where do I get an air purifier? And it's toxic positivity. So I said, you know what? This is normalizing the unconscionable. You know, this is going to lead to people dying. It's going to lead to people going bankrupt with these medical bills. So yeah, I founded it. I think people understand the gravity of the situation. Yeah, people we're willing to risk people's lives for the Dow Jones. And that's kind of the idea, is we're not going to normalize this. It is what it is. And we should be quite frank in our language. This is a homicidal policy, and it's done with intent. And they know it. They know people are going to die, and they did it anyway. And why? That's what we need to focus on, I think, is why. Out of all the things in this pandemic, I think one of the positives is that we learned the nature of our system. Too many people in America have been apolitical. And I think that's because they just feel like there's nothing they can do, or they just don't know who to be mad at. We're in red team, and the people that are informed, it's red versus blue. It's this idea, like I said, again, it's go back to work in school, but die, versus keep your health, but lose your job. That's the situation that both parties put us in. I think that's what we really need to be focused on is, you know, who's running our country? Who are these people in the unions? Where do they play in? So you're paying dues, right? You're paying dues to AFT, NEA, and these other groups. And yeah, you get benefits. And I would never discourage anyone from leaving just yet, but where were they? You know, if there was ever a time when we needed a fight, it was now. And it's not safe. And that's what Teachers Against Dying is all about. It's about the safety issue. It's about unsafe working conditions. It, just as it was, we needed unions, right, to fight for unsafe working conditions in the industrial sector. Well, this is an unsafe working condition. One of the things that I mentioned as well was, we all know what this is, the reason why they made the choice and the drive back to work and school. It's the profit motive. And we have a government that's essentially captured by corporations in lieu of, you know, Citizens United and many other legal precedents before. So that's who we should be fighting against. And it shouldn't be worker versus worker. I just think a more democratic way of doing it, because these national bosses make decisions that we have no say in. Like they decided unilaterally not to use and galvanize their combined 3 million members between NEA and AFT. They could have done something somewhere and at least fought for people like myself and others that, you know, were denied medical accommodations at the bare minimum. They decided not to do that. They decided to do it on a local basis and file grievances after the fact. And that's something I didn't get a vote on. Look, the guidelines aren't happening. In a lot of places, colleagues I talk to, fellow teachers, it ain't happening. You don't even have masks here in Texas. That's the first guideline. If there was any one positive thing that came out of this whole pandemic, I call it the empire has no clothes. I think people are starting to see what things really are. We've been exposed. You know, we have all these military bases. We have, you know, we have all this money to spend on jet aircrafts that fail. We have all this money for corporate bailouts and the CARES Act, but we couldn't contain a pandemic. We couldn't contain a pandemic when we had advanced notice. We had ample resources. And yes, having an incompetent game show host at the helm certainly was a factor. Both parties, they voted for that CARES Act to transfer the wealth up to the rich that were already fabulously wealthy to begin with. They vote for all of the same military budgets. They voted for the Iraq War, the Patriot Act, which is still in place, by the way. And we saw the NSA is spying on us. All of these things are in place. And I don't see the opposition we need from the Democratic Party as a party that represents the average person. I think they're better than the Republicans. I do not make a false equivalency there. I would never say that they're exactly the same. But at the end of the day, on the big stuff that the American people need, they're working for the top. And I think a lot of that has to do, again, is with this system of bribery, this idea that money is speech and corporations are people. And we need to really, if we can find some common ground on that, I think that's the movement we need to have in America. It would have to be a grassroots thing. And I don't see change coming from the top. So we think we're going to vote our way out of this. That's not happening. We've got to get together again on a class basis and start struggling against the common enemy. Thank you.
recent massacre of Asians and others in Atlanta is part of the explosion of xenophobia and race hate in the United States. Unfortunately, it has a long history.
Asian hate! Stop, stop, stop, Asian hate! Stop, stop, stop, Asian hate! There have been many more Filipino people than Asian people like Christian Hall who were murdered by the police out in the East Coast. And that's why the Angelo Pinto's family as well stands with the victims and survivors of police violence, whether it's in Antioch, or in New York, or Boston, anywhere where people have been terrorized by the police. Now we must understand that a system that breeds an organization like the police is part of the reason why we have these acts of violence happening against Asian people, whether here in San Francisco, New York, Atlanta, and we mourn and grieve with people.
Pacifica spoke with Kent Wong, the director of the UCLA Labor Center and founder of the Asian Pacific American Labor Alliance.
Eight people were gunned down in cold blood in Atlanta, Georgia. Six were Asian American women. And this comes at a time when there has been a huge rise in the racially motivated crimes and attacks directed against Asian Americans. There have been more than 3,800 documented attacks on Asian Americans in the last year alone. And this has been a source of tremendous concern and fear within the Asian American community. And I do think that it is something that requires a thoughtful and comprehensive response. Anti-Asian violence and anti-Asian sentiment has deep roots in this country. With the passage of the 1882 Chinese Exclusion Act, for the first time in history, the United States government blocked a group of people from legally entering this country due to their nationality. And the racially restrictive policies that limited Asian migration to the United States were enforced and on the books for more than 80 years. It was not until the civil rights movement in the 1960s that struck down other racially discriminated laws and policies that the remnants of the Chinese Exclusion Act were finally eliminated in the 1960s. You referenced the internment of Japanese Americans during World War II, one of the most heinous civil rights violations in the history of this country, where 110,000 Americans of Japanese descent were rounded up without trial, without due process, without any documentation of a justification, and they were shipped away to some of the most desolate parts of the country. Even since the rise in the immigration among Asians since the 1960s, we have seen persistent problems with anti-Asian policies and anti-Asian violence, in part heightened by the racist rhetoric of the Trump administration that blamed the pandemic on China and on Asian Americans. He referred to it as the China virus. He called it Kung Flu in a derogatory way of blaming Asian Americans for the pandemic. And so we see that these factors have led to this very ugly spike in anti-Asian violence across the country. I am a third generation Chinese American. And yet when people see me and see my last name, they immediately see me as a foreigner, as someone who cannot be trusted, as someone who is not a full American. And so I do think that the China bashing that is from both parties, by the Republicans and the Democrats, not only is nationalistic and bad economic policy, but it also has direct consequences with regard to Asians in this country. Unfortunately, the US labor movement has been complicit in the anti-Asian campaigns in years past. The founding president of the American Federation of Labor, Samuel Gompers, was a lifelong opponent of Asian migration to the United States, and he barred Asian workers in this country from joining unions. So this was the policy that he held on to throughout his entire career. In years past, the US labor movement has advocated for exclusionary policies and segregation policies that have kept other communities of color out of unions and have enforced racially restrictive policies with regard to hiring practices in various sectors of the US economy. As recently as the 1970s and 80s, members of the US unions were embarking on a horrendous anti-Japanese campaign blaming Japan for the demise of the US auto industry. And in 1982, Vincent Chin, a Chinese American engineer, was murdered in cold blood by two unemployed white auto workers who blamed him, a Chinese American, for the rise of Japanese imports that were threatening their jobs. So we think that the US labor movement absolutely has a responsibility to step up during this period and to denounce the racism, to denounce the scapegoat politics that we have seen in too many periods of US history. Unfortunate reality is that we have a lot of union members who voted for Trump. We have a lot of union members who bought in to the racism and misogyny and anti-immigrant hysteria and blamed China, Mexico, blamed communities of color for the loss of economic standing. And I do think that it is critical for the leadership of US unions to speak out against xenophobia, to speak out against racism, sexism, and anti-immigrant attitudes, especially now when we have so many essential workers who are workers of color, are immigrant workers, who are at risk every single day on the job due to corporate greed and a refusal to provide safe work environments for workers on the front lines. That's true with farm workers, that's true with garment workers, that's true with supermarket workers, that's true with warehouse workers. And we really need to ensure that the full contributions of workers of color, of immigrant workers, are understood and embraced not only by the U.S. labor movement, but by society at large.
That was Kent Wong, director of the UCLA Labor Center and founder of the Asian Pacific American Labor Alliance. In March of 2021, the Pacifica National Board passed the following resolution: in defense of Asian, Asian American, and Pacific Islander communities against racist attacks and xenophobia. Whereas there have been escalating attacks on Asians and Asian Americans in the U.S., including mass shootings, as well as physical and verbal attacks. Whereas former President Trump's rhetoric blaming China for the pandemic caused by the COVID-19 virus has contributed to the anti-Asian sentiment in this country. Whereas there is a long history in the U.S. of systemic discrimination and racist legislation that has excluded Asians from citizenship and human rights. Whereas the growing economic crisis has been used by racist and fascist forces to blame immigrants, including Asians. Whereas this has been combined with a constant negative coverage of China in the media, with both Democrats and Republicans supporting the military encirclement of China in a growing trade war, which could lead to a military conflict between two nuclear powers. Whereas China bashing has led to growing xenophobia and blaming of Asians and Asian Americans for the economic crisis in the United States. Whereas Pacifica's mission is in radio broadcasting operations to engage in any activity that shall contribute to the lasting understanding between nations and between the individuals of all nations, races, creeds, and colors, to gather and disseminate information on the causes of conflict between any and all of such groups, and through any and all means compatible with the purposes of this corporation, to promote the study of political and economic problems and of the causes of religious, philosophical, and racial antagonisms. Therefore, resolved that the Pacifica National Board condemns the attacks on the Asian community and Asian people in the United States and opposes China bashing and xenophobia by politicians of both parties, and will actively seek to provide a platform for the voices of Asians and Asian Americans who are organizing to defend their communities and educate the public about these issues. And that concludes today's edition of COVID, Race, and Democracy. We thank all of Pacifica's sister stations and its radio affiliates who contribute to the production of this show. Today's show was produced by Steve Zeltzer, with production assistance from Polina Vasiliev and Anne Garrison. Our executive producers are Akua Holt, Polina Vasiliev, and Steve Zeltzer. You can find this and all previous episodes at our website, covidtaskforce.pacifica.org. I'm Tanya Horlick of KMUD 91.1 FM, Garberville, California. Thanks for listening.